What's going on, fantastic people of the internet, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. And my goodness, do I have a treat for everybody today. So in this week's episode, I sat down with the serial technology entrepreneur turned venture capital investor, Brian Caulfield. I don't think Brian needs much of an introduction, but to give you some idea on what Brian has accomplished to date and to put the majority of us to shame, Brian has started, sold, and invested into a huge number of businesses over the years and is a venture partner at the renowned Draper Esprit. I think the majority of us would know Draper, but if not, definitely links in the show notes to that VC firm. So Brian currently describes himself as a VC investor on a sabbatical, and I was fortunate enough to sit down with Brian and to pick his brain on entrepreneurship, his journey, and what it was like to raise venture capital in Ireland when it pretty much didn't exist. We got into some amazing topics around, you know, Brian's early years and just the whole journey of entrepreneurship and what that means. A lot of different team dynamics and how making sure that the right different characteristic of team members exist in order to excel or push a company forward. This is a really, really good episode, and I think anybody who is either currently an entrepreneur or thinking about becoming one could learn some really valuable lessons here. I guess I could also say that we only really scratched the surface, We didn't even get to, I don't think, to the 2000s even of Brian's career, but a lot of different tangents were talked about, and I think that the value of the content in this is huge. So I'm going to stop rabbiting on and I'm going to jump straight into the show. I hope you enjoy it, and please, any feedback will be thoroughly appreciated. Enjoy. Here with the awesome Brian Caulfield, whose story precedes himself. And I guess what I do, Brian, at the start of every podcast is to allow the guests to, not allow, but to invite the guests to introduce themselves, for fear more than anything that I will butcher it myself.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me on. I suppose in terms of introduction, originally I'm a computer engineer. I'm not going to tell you when I graduated. It was quite a while ago. I did a couple of years of postgrad research. Very briefly had a real job working for a Swiss multinational, and then started my first business. I've been a co-founder of three startups, two reasonable successes, one failure, which, by the way, had the best technology by a country mile of any of the three.
Yes.
And then more recently, I've spent most of the last kind of 15, 16 years of my career in the venture capital world, investing in technology companies, initially in Ireland, and in more recent years across Europe. So that's the short version.
Very good. That's it's amazing to hear the story. And I think what I'm always really interested in is, I myself knew at a very early age that my passion lay somewhere within the technology space. And I was very lucky to understand that, mainly because my dad, for some crazy reason, he enjoyed technology himself, but at, you know, age, I think maybe 5 or 6, I had a computer in the household. And from that, I was able to get books and Java and learn everything and kind of realize that this machine would allow me to take what was in my imagination and to build things. And
I wonder about that journey for yourself. At a very early age, did you have different exposures to things that kind of led you on the path that you're on at the moment?
In many ways, a very sort of similar story, actually, Brian. You know, my dad was an accountant. He was the finance director of John Hind, the postcard company. And he hated it. And from a very sort of early stage, after we moved back to Ireland from the UK, my dad actually sort of taught himself to code and was building effectively business software for the John Hine business in his spare time. So at a very early stage, we would have had, you know, Sinclair, early Sinclair nice. Computers. We had an Apple IIe at one stage. We had what passed for a portable PC in the days when it was comfortably the size of a very heavy sewing machine and looked something similar. So yeah, that was definitely a kind of a big influence. And I think my dad was actually a very creative person locked in a job that in many ways wasn't terribly creative. His father had been a musician. And I think the other kind of big thing that I got from my parents, both my parents grew up in council houses, one in Drimna, one in Kilmainham. When I was 12, both my parents went to college, you know. So a huge value on education and the kind of the value of education in my house, which has certainly kind of followed me through, you know.
Wow. Because I know that you went on then to Trinity College yourself, but just before we jump into that, was it almost a prerequisite growing up in that household that you would go to college?
Oh, very much so, yes. I mean, I suppose for my mother, for example, it had been her dream to be a teacher even when she was kind of 14, 15, 16, but that really wasn't an option for her. And, you know, the idea that I would not have gone to college would definitely not have been an option. And, you know, to some extent, I think when I was finishing school, I wasn't 100% sure on, if you like, what career path I wanted to pursue. And my parents were implacably opposed to the idea that I might take a year out, because they were terrified that if I did that, I might never go back to college, you know.
Yeah.
And one of the things that sort of made me choose the engineering qualification in Trinity was that I felt that it was something that left the future very open, left the possibilities very open, because you started in a broad-based engineering course where you didn't even have to choose whether you want to do civil or mechanical or electronic or computer engineering. So it was kind of very much, okay, I've got to go to college. I'm definitely going to college. What can I do that is going to leave me with the broadest possible range of choices when I graduate, you know?
I find this really interesting, and I've noticed a pattern in quite a lot of entrepreneurs where, and I'm not sure if you quantify yourself as an entrepreneur, would you put yourself in that box? I feel always that you should let somebody else kind of define who they are rather than me jumping the gun there. But that at an early age, that kind of magnetism towards the logical structure of engineering and knowing that it's foundational and building blocks and you can almost create whatever your mind can dream up. But what seems to come later is the business acumen and the emotional side behind that whole set of let's say, the fence. And it's something that took me a superb amount of time to get right, where at an early age, I was full sure that the computer was something that allowed me to build. So it unlocked my potential in a way. Mm-hmm. Only to realize later on, and something I wish I learned earlier, is that it isn't computers that unlock my potential, it's people. And that whole suite around that, that emotional intelligence piece, that understanding of products and business and everything that kind of sits in between there, you know, as you kind of push forward through Trinity College, was there any kind of business ideas that were dreamt up or any exposure to that side of it?
So firstly, I think it's a really interesting point, and I think, you know, maybe you and I both are very lucky in some respects, because, you know, we've been blessed with the intellectual capability and the analytical mindset on the one hand, but also a reasonably high degree of communication skills. And, you know, not everybody gets both the analytical capability and the communication skills. And, you know, a huge sort of learning experience for me when I started my first my first job, my brief real job, was that, you know, I was actually a very good engineer, but that in many cases, my ability to communicate with people and my ability to, if you like, bring people with me was in many cases much, much more important than my technical engineering skills. I think it's a fantastic combination, and it's part of the genetic lottery that you kind of that you end up with these things. We're all familiar with the stereotype of the engineer who's kind of scruffy and uncommunicative, and that's actually, I think, a real thing. Some of the greatest engineers that I've ever worked with really haven't had fantastic communication skills, and, you know, they can still be incredibly productive and enormously valuable to any business, but they do have it harder in terms of dealing with the kind of the people aspects of business, you know.
It's a amazing point, and I think So I briefly discussed this in a previous episode around, you know, in some respects, when you take the artist or the musician or the footballer even, their inability to sell themselves or to even hold on to that characteristic in order to understand how to present themselves in a valuable context towards whatever situation they may be in. If they don't grasp that, they tend to fall back on this other scenario of the idea of an agent, where an agent will go and negotiate the deals on their behalf and go and sell them and kind of really understand the scenario and take on that sales role. And I think that in some introverted or, you know, different characteristics of some engineers or people in every field, really, where that ability to sell yourself may not be very strong, I often find that people really do themselves a disservice, because the value that they actually bring to the business versus their ability to get that out can bring them back a little bit, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I mean, even if you look at the kind of emerging emphasis on neurodiversity, you have really only in the past few years this emerging realization that there's a universe of people who at some level or other are on the kind of the autism spectrum disorder. They're somewhere on that spectrum. And if I probably shouldn't use the word deficit, but if you like, the deficit that they have at one level is exactly that, you know, that ability to sell themselves and engage in the conversation around their own value. So yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to see that dynamic being recognized. And you're absolutely right, it is a dynamic that's characteristic of a lot of other creative industries in particular, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting, and this is kind of off topic, but one of the things that always bugs me is when you hear people talking about programming as being primarily a mathematical skill. I just really don't, it's not that mathematical skills and logical skills don't matter, of course they do, but programming languages are called that for a reason. You know, because linguistic skills are enormously important in programming. And, you know, if you think fundamentally what it's all about, it's your ability to express the solution to a problem in a formal language, you know. And I think this actually becomes a barrier to participation in the craft, this notion that it's all about your ability to do maths, which I think is kind of dangerous and often damaging for people.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with all of those points. And I remember, I'm not sure who it was, I think it was Rans, or somebody, I'll find out and I'll put his name and a link to this in the description. But he talks about this concept of stables and volatiles, where you have people who are stable, and maybe if we're to take even both of those personas and apply them to an engineering capacity, that if you had a stable who is very to-do list orientated, very meticulous, very model-driven, refactoring, etc., and then you have somebody who is volatile, extremely fast, creative, wants to get something out there and get other people to use it as soon as possible. The best scenario, and people often can, you know, people often say that Steve Jobs would be the volatile, but Tim Cook would be the stable. That supply chain in China, that whole strategy around supply chain going to Tim Cook and the actual product development going to Steve Jobs. When you have both, it is an amazing situation and something that can really, really drive a business or a product forward. But if you have two stables or two volatiles or just one of each, you'll notice that overall the dynamic doesn't really perform in the same instance. And I find that really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with that. And I think in many cases, well, I was going to say the worst combination is two volatiles, but actually I'm not so sure about that. I think, though, that you can also see certain situations, and I absolutely saw this in my first business where I started with actually three other co-founders. One of the guys dropped out relatively early on. His wife had had their second child, and the... you know, it just for him, it was a point where he couldn't deal with the risk and the minimal pay and so on anymore, and decided he actually went to work for an insurance company. But my other two co-founders were almost exactly those kind of archetypes that you've just described. You know, one guy who was incredibly hardworking, very focused, very detail-oriented. You know, the guy who kind of, if you like, got stuff done.
Yeah.
The other guy was extremely creative, very articulate, highly, highly intelligent, and, you know, had an incredible ability to relate to the motivations of people in a group in a way that meant, for example, to this day, if I had to do a really, really tough meeting, there are few people I'd sooner do it with than this this guy. But he was also, it's probably fair to say, lazy, a little bit unreliable. He was a menace in many respects, because if he was asked by a customer, you know, can the product do X, he would say no, think for about 10 seconds and say, but, you know, we could easily make it, you know, here's how we'd do it. And, you know, we'd kind of come out of the meeting and I'd be thinking, Jesus Christ, Bill, that's 2 man years of dev time to do that. And he'd actually frequently use the word trivial. And what he meant by trivial was, I've conceived this in my head. I see how the pieces go together. And, you know, once conceptually I understand it, it's trivial. The other co-founder would be thinking much more about the plan and the 2 years of dev time and, you know, how many people we needed on the team and, you know, what the milestones were and so on. And they really kind of bumped up against each other. And you know, I remember the volatile component there at one stage saying about his co-founder that he was untroubled by original thought, you know. And they ultimately couldn't work together, you know, so it can be tough to get that that dynamic right. And it's funny, I'm not sure which I am. I think I'm probably slightly more on the volatile side, but with probably enough of the stable to manage to get things done. And I think I think one of the characteristics that's so enormously important in a successful startup founder is self-awareness.
Yes.
And I think a really, really good self-aware founder will be so conscious of their own personal limitations and the things that they do well and the things that they do badly, that they will really recognize the value and importance of, you know, hiring people or finding co-founders that kind of complement them. And if you don't have that self-awareness, you're just not really able to do that.
Yeah, you know? Brian, you're talk about on the money. So with myself, I would try to be as self-aware as possible, but I realized that I would definitely fall into the volatile category. And even the point that you said that once it's conceptually possible to me, it becomes obtainable,
mm-hmm.
and by proxy possible to the client at sliding timelines and so on. And the more and more that I've become aware of that characteristic, the more that I've placed people around me in the business to, I often imagine it as I'm this balloon filled with helium floating above, but Steve, the CTO in MiniCorp, is holding on to the string and saying, you know, go and fly, but just not too far, you know, that I'm here to ground that whole process and to make sure that we have a good relationship, a good conversation about where that's happening.
Yeah.
And I think a second thing that you said, and is very important, is as you can imagine, in that relationship, myself and Steve are always closely connected together. And without the self-awareness from both of us to understand that we're never there to hurt each other, we're only there to grow the business, the communication opens up a lot easier, and we trust each other to a huge extent to know that one is almost taking the other's place where we see downfall in each other, you know? And yeah. it's a vital part, I think, in the growth of MiniCorp.
Yeah, and I think in all great businesses, and, you know, you look even at a business like Facebook and, you know, leaving aside yeah. their current challenges,
sure.
you have to say, what an incredible business has been built there. And you look at the personalities of Zuckerberg versus Sheryl Sandberg, and I think you see exactly that dynamic. And from what I can see externally, at least, and, you know, I've no kind of direct personal insight into this, there seems to be deep mutual respect between those two people, and you know, respect for their perspectives and respect for what they bring to the party. And I think if you can get that kind of dynamic, I mean, I was very lucky. I ended up with a guy running my engineering team called Gary Ramsey. And Gary is just one of the most kind of grounded, solid guys that you could ever hope to meet. I always knew that Gary would give it to me straight between the eyes if he felt there was an issue that I wasn't dealing with, or, you know, if there was a problem that needed to be dealt with. I kind of remember to this day my sort of meetings with Gary, where Gary would have like a sheet written in pencil, always pencil. Gary, if you're out there, I don't know why. And it would tiny writing all these bullet points, and it would be, you know, we're going through these points and we're ticking them off, and, you know, and he was a fantastic, you know, foil to me from that perspective, and somebody that I came to rely on totally, you know. The other thing that I think, in especially in businesses, once they start to generate a bit of scale, the reality is that most founders tend to be on the volatile side, and the characteristics of people that kind of give them the creativity, the irrational optimism about what's possible, the irrational optimism about their capability to deliver something, are in many respects kind of inimical to running a scaling business and putting in place the structures and so on that you need to make that work. So I think for once you get to the stage of scaling, a great CFO is an incredible foil to a strong founder CEO, you know, somebody who is the person who is saying, well, you know, Brian, you do understand that if we do that, this is what the implications are going to be. And, you know, if you really want to do that, then we're going to need to think about how we address those implications. But that does require the mutual respect and the kind of the understanding that your CFO isn't trying, as you said, they're not trying to hurt you, you know.
But that's the really, really difficult thing. Yeah. And I think, you know, even the way that you transcribe that conversation of the CFO saying, well, you know, Mr. or Mrs. CEO, if you're willing or you want to do this, here's the implications of doing it, almost stating that, you know, it is your decision to make, but here's what would happen if you say yes, and here's what would happen if you say no. So there's, first of all, the trust from the CFO to the CEO to make the right decision, but also the trust from the CEO to listen to the advice of the CFO and to take it on board and push forward. So I think there's a lot of learning there. So I think, you know, without going too far down there, because I think me and you would just have a conversation on this for days, it'd be really interesting to hear about your first startup. First of all, if we could even start it, when it happened, how you found these people, and how you found the problem to be solved.
So I, if you'd ask me in college, you know, did I see myself as an entrepreneur, I would never have even known how to answer that question, you know. So how my first startup came about was that I was working for a small subsidiary of a company called Landis & Gyr, a Swiss multinational with kind of 20,000 people and 2 billion turnover at the time. They got themselves into trouble. I won't bore you with how. And as a result, they were either shutting down or selling off anything that they deemed to be non-core. And we were definitely non-core, and they were going to shut down this small Irish subsidiary, which at the time was called Peregrine Expert Systems.
Sure.
And to me, it seemed entirely logical at that stage that we should set up our own business, if you like, kind of a phoenix from the flames kind of scenario. There were probably only about 20 to 25 people in the company at the time, and most of them took the sensible course, if you like, and they went off and they got real jobs. My perception of this, I suppose, crisis, you know, we were all being laid off, was that it was an opportunity. And, you know, I really thought that any sensible person presented with the same situation would have done the same thing. In reality, it was probably, you know, my friends who kind of knew me better than I knew myself who kind of said to me, are you kidding? You know, A, it's crazy. And certainly in 1992, doing a tech startup in Ireland probably was pretty crazy. And B, you were always crazy anyway, you know. And they were able to actually relate kind of incidents from my past that sort of that when you looked at them with that lens, kind of all of a sudden it makes sense. So
sure.
I started with 3 co-founders. We were all technical, all engineers, although 2 of us had probably increasingly been focused on kind of managing client relationships in the business and that kind of thing. In terms of the initial product idea, that actually came from one of my co-founders. We were, believe it or not, a very early AI technology company in 1992. And he had done some work in AIB, specifically in AIB's credit card center, looking to identify potential applications of early AI technology in AIB, and he'd identified 4 opportunities, and this was kind of the one that looked most interesting and exciting, and you know, so that was where the kind of the product idea came from. Personally, I've always found engaging with customers, engaging with, if you like, people who have a problem ultimately, is far and away the best way to kind of to uncover kind of product and market opportunities. And it's not necessarily that you just come up with something that solves their problem. It's maybe the recognition that I can take your problem and generalize it to a much larger class of users. And then suddenly you've got a really interesting market opportunity, because you have, if you like, a problem that's reasonably generic across a wide range of users, which means you've got a big market, you know.
So may I ask, I know that you said 92 when this happened, and I don't want to, but it probably will happen. What age were you when you started the business?
26. No, actually, I was 27.
So, like, you know, 27-year-old in 92 taking a risk like that would have been... I've no idea, but I would nearly assume that people were extremely risk-averse back then, so technology wouldn't have been even, you know, well-known or well-discussed at that point to be a blatantly new sector in lots of regards. Not to say that we're archaic or anything in Ireland, but more when you look at how people jump into companies in any technology play at the moment, it's just, it's one of the hot topics. How did your parents react to this situation?
That's an interesting question. You know, I don't think it bothered them in the slightest.
You had done your college and they were happy.
I guess. I'd done my college. I'd sort of successfully graduated. And, you know, I think my parents always took the view... Well, firstly, hey, you know, once you're out of college, you're kind of an adult and you make decisions for yourselves. But also, I think we had been brought up to be very, very independent, you know. From quite a young age, I'd always been doing part-time jobs. You know, I caddied on the local golf course. I delivered newspapers. I worked in a coffee shop, you know. And, you know, I was delivering these free, Southside it was called at the time, these free newspapers locally. And myself and one of my brothers, unfortunately the guy who died last summer, we put endless work both into figuring out the most efficient route for us to deliver these newspapers and also ways to optimize our time.
Engineer, oh my goodness.
Yeah, exactly. Like at the age of, I was probably 13 or something, you know. And we figured out that if we could get our mother to drop bundles of the papers at certain locations on the route, that we could really optimize the shit out of the time it would take us to do the route, you know.
I find this really interesting. And what probably is the most interesting is what you just a few sentences ago, you're saying that with the that idea of bringing AIB and the AI to that and understanding the solution, but also understanding from a more broader term whether this could be something that could be applied market-wide and globally. It's strange. I think our minds work in a very similar way, where once you have a problem or you see something in front of you, as I grew older, I then realized that, okay, that's, you know, a localized instance of a paper drop, but how would more people start to use this technology of, you know, having really strategic paper drops or, you know, anything into box A or make it more into, I guess, an equation rather than an actual strategy?
Yeah, and you know, I'd say it took us a little while because we first had to figure things out, like, you know, how many can we carry without, you know, without it being too much, and therefore, you know, how That's often crazy. Do we need to resupply and so on, you know.
So what happened to the business in the end?
So, very, very interesting ride. We were one of the first very small Irish companies to raise venture capital. I mean, fundamentally in 1992, wow, there was no venture capital industry as we understand it today in Ireland. In 96, we raised, I think it was 300,000 Irish pounds from Delta Partners. Shay Garvey at the time was the partner there that we dealt with.
Oh my goodness.
None of us had ever seen a check that size, and it was actually a check, a kind of a big physical check. And we built the business over a period of a few more years. We went through all the dot-com craziness. In 1999, we were planning to merge with an American company called Paylinx. We were going to go public on NASDAQ. Lehman Brothers, who are no longer with us, were writing the S-1.
Yay.
And the Lehman Brothers guys were telling us, so, okay, you'll go public at $400 million market cap, and quickly trade up to $1 billion, right?
Well, at a minimum threshold, I'd say.
Absolutely. And this was just going to happen. There was no kind of milestones that we needed to hit or anything that we really needed to achieve to make this happen. It would just happen automatically. And I mean, at the time, the two companies together probably had no more than about $15 million of revenue, you know, which shows just how crazy it was. Unfortunately, we were scheduled to go public in May 2000. March 2000 was the first big blip in the NASDAQ market, the first intimation of the kind of the dot-com crash and the nuclear winter to come. So Paylinx sold themselves to a company called CyberSource. The theory was CyberSource were going to acquire us as well, but we became nervous about that, and we ended up selling the business to Trintech, who were already public on NASDAQ.
Right.
So that would have been, I guess we did the deal kind of middle of 2000 or late summer 2000, and actually closed it in November of 2000. So yeah, that was the...
Isn't that crazy though? So I must ask this question. There was obviously, you know, so what I would assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the partner who's writing the S1 is the partner who's going to help you to bring this IPO to the market, or to put the weight behind it in a way. And when you're having those discussions with whoever it is in Lehman Brothers, did you at any point step away or go to the toilet or grab a cup of coffee and go, overnight, I'm going to go from a value of X to a value of Y, and there is no, because it breaks my mind in a way to know that the value that I put into the company is what, you know, I get a yield out of it in a way.
Mm.
But in this context, it's not really a yield. All of a sudden, it just becomes this, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I absolutely did think about it. My wife, Helen, was also involved in the business, and she was also a shareholder. And I remember thinking, you know, between the two of us after the IPO, we'll still own something like 16% of the business. And
160 million,
you know, so 160 million, hey, you know, that's not bad,
yeah.
You know. And then it all came kind of crashing down, and the sort of Trintech's stock had been $300 a share. They did a 4-for-1 split, which brought it down to 75 just before things started to go south. When we did the deal, it was about $22 a share. When we closed and announced the deal, it was down around 10. And at Christmas that year, I sold a chunk of stock at $10.50 a share. And I remember saying to my wife, it couldn't go any lower. And when the next stock came out of the lockup, it was 40 cents a share.
Oh my God.
But you know what? That didn't bother me, you know. I was never I guess I never really felt, even at that level, like I had the money, so I didn't kind of mourn its loss. And actually, I think most great entrepreneurs are not particularly motivated by money per se, you know. I think they're more motivated by solving the problem, you know. And actually, some of the greatest entrepreneurs that I've met are, you know, really passionate about the problem that they solve, often based on a very personal experience of the problem. And, you know, the money is kind of secondary, you know.
And it's a huge point that really resonates with myself in thinking, because of the market turn, that had an effect on the outcome of what happened. But realistically, the value that you guys had created within the company and everything that was built during that time of that product is a huge, huge testament to yourselves. Like, you had done it, sure. Like, there's outside factors that really influence the overall outcome of the situation. But from what you had started with to what you had built and all of the strategy, everything to do with the company in between, that's a huge accomplishment.
I guess, yeah. And thank you for the compliment. It's kind of interesting. I look back on it now, and I had an experience just in the past few days where I was speaking at an event in Talent Garden in DCU, and a woman approached me and said, you know, I'd really like to get some time with you. And it turned out that she knows many people who worked for me in my first business.
Wow.
I hadn't met her, but she was kind of reeling off, you know, Adele Egan and Mairead Flanagan and all of these people who had worked with me in the first business. And she was kind of telling me, firstly, they had been saying to her, you should really talk to Brian. And they thankfully held me in high regard. And I'd kind of be, if you like, prouder of that in one respect than the financial outcome, you know, that people felt that it was a good environment to work with, to work in, that I had given them opportunities to develop and improve themselves, and that they had enjoyed working as part of that team.
And it's an absolute huge testament to yourself. I think, like, just from my own personal conversations and dealings with yourself, you're probably one of the most approachable VCs, or you know, you're extremely giving with your time, even though there may not be a benefit to your side of the fence at all. I think your willingness to help educate companies and startups and founders is amazing, and you should be really proud of that. I think, so I know that we're quite an amount in to this episode already, and I would prefer to keep the next set of companies maybe for an additional episode or something in the future.
Sure.
But there is one thing, just to kind of close off the company that we're on at the moment, and something that really resonates with myself, is that VC capital back then would have been, you know, extremely unobtainable, if even available at all. And for you guys to find a VC and to get a check of that size back then is a feat in itself. And I wonder, so first of all, you're starting to use instruments or funds and funding that just is a new method of thinking, which is, you know, would have been unheard of then. How did you come up with that and figure out that was available? And number two, what were those conversations like? Did you have to, put anything behind this yourself in order to secure that deal and everything around that?
Mm. So we didn't really have any kind of personal assets to put into the deal. The company already had some revenue. I think, I'm going to say we were maybe doing $250,000 a year of revenue, something like that. You know, we were able to pay ourselves pretty modest salaries, but we certainly had no kind of savings to put in alongside the investors. I think if we were at a point where the venture capital industry was just starting to emerge, and we knew we needed capital. I mean, one of the challenges of our business up to that stage had been we were building a product in the era of, you know, exclusively on-prem technology. You know, the kind of whole concept of agile or lean development didn't exist. And especially in the banking sector, you know, if you wanted to build a product for banks, that cost $5 million. You know, building a product cost $5 million. It was simple as that. And we'd been feeding ourselves through doing bits of consulting work and so on while building the product. And it was just slow. And we knew we needed to find a way to break out of that scenario and really focus 100% of our efforts on the product, you know. So, I mean, that was kind of the driver. I think in those days, it was infinitely harder to get venture capital. And at one level, I think perhaps today it's become a little bit too easy, and it's perceived as being a kind of an end in itself, you know. I kind of worry when I'm having a conversation with an entrepreneur who's kind of saying to me, you know, what do I need to change to make my business interesting to you? Yeah, that happens all the time. And I sort of feel in that scenario, already we're having the wrong conversation, you know. I think, you know, you as an entrepreneur, you should build the business that you want to build, you know, and perhaps I can ramp your ambition for the business and say, okay, if you had more fuel, you know, could you go faster? But when you're asking me, how do I change my business to make it interesting to VC? I just think that's kind of the wrong question to be asking. So I think it's incredibly important that people think about VC as being a means to an end, not an end in itself. And what they should be thinking about is, you know, firstly, can I grow the value of my own equity stake in the business, and I emphasize the value of your equity stake in the business, faster with external capital than without, right? And if the answer to that question is no, then you probably shouldn't be raising capital. And if the answer is yes, you still have to ask yourself another question, which is, can I live with the compromises inherent in having a new shareholder in the business who expects to get a return and you know, ultimately to liquidate the business in order to generate a return? And you need to be able to get comfortable with that as well. I think now people too often just see, you know, another thing I hate to see, for example, is founders who, you know, on their LinkedIn profile talk about how much money they raised. You know, it's not an achievement, you know.
I could tell you, so I'll tell one more story just before we go, and that's, so obviously in Minicorp we have quite substantial conversations and lots of conversations around really early stage products, early stage companies. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's well known that if we get on well with the company, we'll actually leave this point for the next episode instead. Brian, thank you very much. I think I'll leave in the show notes lots of different ways of how to contact you and your social media and everything in there. And I want to say a huge thank you for taking this time. I really, really appreciate it.
Not at all. I enjoyed the chat, Brian. Thanks very much.
Cheers. Thank you.